Congress is considering the president's fiscal year 15 budget at this very time. And as usual, we start our fiscal year 2016 summer budget planning process. So we're always looking ahead as well. Just quickly on health reform, you all know we completed the first open enrollment period for the ACA, and we published the enrollment data for the whole period. We published the month by month figures, and now we put together an overall report for the whole period, which is up on our website as well. We were using administrative data, largely supplied to us by CMS from the healthcare.gov website, as well as some state-based data provided by some of the states that run their own state-based exchanges. In terms of measuring and monitoring the progress of ACA, we sort of, in the data area anyway, we sort of have two dimensions. One is the reliance on administrative data to see how we're doing, and the second is on population survey data. The data that we published on enrollment is based from on the application, the standard simplified application. It included enrollment by metal level, by age and gender, and so on. And we actually published one report that had a bit of information on race, ethnicity, as well. So there was a lot of non-response to that, to those items on the application. For the states, the 14 or 17 states that run their own exchanges, we have less information. We have to rely on what they report to us. On the survey side, again, we're probably we should have estimates from the National Health Interview Survey for that first quarter of the year, January, February, March, coming up from the early release program. That should be available in, I think we're planning September, so that will be the first glimpse of what the, from a national probability survey, what the enrollment looks like, what the insurance coverage profile looks like, and so on. So we'll be looking at that later in the year. A number of, just as an aside, you remember that a number of foundations and other groups that run telephone surveys and web surveys and other sorts of things, they published their estimates in the meantime, month by month. You have to have very large sample sizes to be able to do a month-to-month change in insurance coverage. And a number of those surveys, ultimately they have very low response rates, and they're ultimately not necessarily probability based. Nevertheless, they are publishing them, and they seem to show where health insurance is going and so on. So we'll see how it all comes together in September. I think I mentioned previously we've made enhancements to most of our surveys to monitor the implementation and the impact of health reform. We continue to work with the Census Bureau and our major survey agencies here to look at what we're planning to publish ultimately on health reform. This is very good news, at least for HHS and users of HHS data. This is a project long in the making. We've now have an NCHS research data center here at Humphrey. So it's in Aspie, but we're calling it an HHS research data center. The research data, remember when we released data, some of it is public use, so it can be made available without conditions, though they're very small. Then we have various dimensions of restricted use. We can have data that can be given to you for research purposes after review, subject to a data use agreement. We have other even more restricted approaches which require access only through, this is what the census does as well, only through a designated agency research data center, in which you submit your analysis request. It's done under very secure conditions. No one ever gets to see individual records, and you walk away with your analysis. You don't walk away with any records. So we sort of have the full spectrum of data release here. the NCHS Research Data Center is one of those where you walk away with the analysis, you don't walk away with any records. So, and we're letting CBO has already gotten three jobs in there, so we're trying to find out what they're up to. And HHS downtown will be using it as well. I wanted to mention that OMB has launched an initiative, I think many of you heard about this, on making better use of administrative data that the federal government holds for statistical purposes. And the thought here is that the statistics agencies like the Census Bureau and some of our own agencies could really benefit. In fact, the census looks at ways to actually substitute administrative data ultimately for what the decennial census would look like by having access to a variety of administrative data. But such data can often be used for sample frames and research survey frames, as well as for linking. We've all linked Medicare claims data to our survey and research projects as well. We've used data from Social Security, the Continuous Work History file, as well as the Death Master file, the National Death Index. We have used data from agriculture on the Supplemental Nutrition Program. IRS, we haven't actually cracked that today. That's a tough area to get. But the idea here is to take a renewed look at the administrative data holdings of our federal agencies and to put together the statistics agencies as well as the programmatic agencies and to put everyone's heads together to see if are there opportunities for cost savings, for efficiencies, and for enhanced analysis by using some of the administrative data, again, where the privacy and the programmatic statutes permit that. So in a sense, it's a within the government operation for the moment, but the linked data could ultimately be made available under secure and restricted circumstances as well. We continue to look at data that we might need for measuring the health and the impact of programs and policies on vulnerable populations generally. I think I mentioned we did our standards earlier, which expanded the potential for information on race, ethnicity, on primary language, on disability, and so on. And more recently, we are trying to improve data on the LGBT population. We are in the process of adding additional questions to a number of our HHS surveys, and we'll be at the point where probably half a dozen or more of our surveys will include questions on sexual orientation. Other vulnerable populations are the disabled population, obviously, and rural populations and minority populations as well. I mentioned this before, just an overview, but we're in the process of updating the data in our health system tracking project, and we'll be moving it to a new platform, a little more user-friendly, in the months ahead. There we have five or four measures. The goal here is to just use some to monitor some indicators in the health system to see how we're doing over time with the various policy and programs that are now in place. The domains that are included are access to care, so there are five or so measures in each one of those areas, cost and affordability, insurance coverage, quality of care, vulnerable populations, health workforce, innovation, population health, prevention and health information technology. So we have at least five measures in each of those areas. This is a public-facing website, so you can see. And we update the information as soon as the agency produces it for that time. Let's see. I think I talked previously. I'll just highlight again, and then I'll talk about some of our projects. About a year and a half ago, the HHS Data Council was asked to look at our portfolio data and our plans, data collection activities, and to see are there areas where we could improve access, improve turnaround, improve availability, and so on. So the council put together a data strategy, which I would be happy to brief the committee on, by the way, when we on full time get your feedback. But one of the goals was to address all of our high priority data gaps in a coordinated fashion. The second focus really was on are there ways to data collection, as you know, primary data collection is very expensive. Response rates are falling, and the data is never available when people really seem to be asking for it. So we looked at areas where under the general rubric of research and development and technology that we could apply some newer technologies to some of our HHS data collections. So this would include web-based data collections, their telephone collections, their other, and obviously electronic health records. So we had a number of projects developed under that initiative. Many of them are in the nature of piloting some of this technology for some of our surveys and research. And I'll for example, we're working with the National Health Interview Survey to see if we can't develop a web-based component of the survey. Clearly, you couldn't have an entirely web-based survey now, given who's representative, who isn't, who has access to that technology. But there are ways to fit that in and other technologies in and to turn around things quicker. Most of our agencies now have programs where they have improved the release time. They used to be 2 years. They're probably within a year or less now, and several of them have early release programs that are down to 6 months, quarterly data within 6 months of the quarter, and that's what we're using for the health interview survey. And we're looking at other areas as well. The other area, sort of the third leg of the stool, was on the theme that the committee has been using as well, and it's how do we align and integrate these various data sources and resources so that we're moving forward, number one, in a way that enhances them all, and number two, provides data that we can actually use and actually can we pilot that. So here we're looking at how do we align our survey data, surveillance data, research data, administrative data, and what will increasingly become available through EHRs. How do we plan what sort of a framework do we need to be sure that as we move forward on each of those, they are cognizant of the others. Standards help a lot here. Standards and conventions help a lot, as well as timelines. And we started down that. I think the committee is using the same concept here as well. And in that regard, we're engaging in several pilots where we can try to, an example, we're looking at how can we use the fruits of electronic health records for our healthcare surveys, the emergency department survey, the ambulatory care survey, hospital discharge survey, and so on. So we have a number of pilots going on now. So we're trying to get beyond it's more than a proof of concept. It's sort of assuming that for some part of the issue that will work, and that we're now trying to actually do that in partnership with NCHS and with ARC. We have also looked at where there are primary care research networks that are agency sponsored and others that have EHRs. We're looking at how can we use those resources to do research and surveillance. And one area is on hard to reach populations, and a second one was on small populations, for example, several race ethnicity subgroups that would be hard to reach generally in the survey or the study. So those are going along, and we're about to publish the fruits of that latter study on our website. So, and then, of course, underlying all of this is, so what good is the data if nobody gets it? So the whole idea of data availability and dissemination is probably one of our highest priorities. Many of you were at the Datapalooza. There were a lot of interesting things there. It's really progressing nicely from the first one where many of you attended to now where they're fairly, you know, we're beyond this graduate student stage of projects and we're into a little more adolescence and even beyond in some cases. So there were some very nice activities there. HHS has published over 1,000 data sets and tools on healthdata.gov, way beyond any other agency. We continue to identify data sets and to do so. And then quickly, I'll just do the a couple of projects that we have in the works now. I think I mentioned previously that we're trying to track the low-income population and how they fare, how the population fares in the era of health reform and other initiatives. So we're using MEPS and Health Interview Survey there, and we're trying to add a large sample of about 1,000 additional low-income households to the MEPS that we would follow over time. In addition, we've created a longitudinal component to the MEPS insurance component, where they go to insurance plans and get a survey of the plans themselves. We even have state data there, I think. We have a project in the works with NCHS, with the healthcare division there, and it's really looking at transitioning to ICD-10. And here we're not looking at how the bills pay, how the reimbursement changes. There the idea is looking at does the move to 10 from 9, does it change, how does it change our population health indicators, so our health profiles, our health data, our health statistics. So we're just starting that with NCHS. It will involve coding information from probably the ambulatory care survey both ways and doing the analysis and see how it might change. So that's an interesting one as well. We've added a large group of community health centers now to our ambulatory care survey at NCHS, so we have a good we'll get a look at how that fits in. And we were asked to look at the impact of the Affordable Care Act on public health. So in two areas, on public health service programs, for example, the community health centers, for example, or the breast and cervical cancer program at CDC. These are service programs. They provide screening. Sometimes they provide follow-up and reimbursement as well. So as the insurance coverage expands and Medicaid expansion occurs as well, and so the source of the insurance is the source of a lot of the reimbursement, how does that affect our grantees, both as providers and as economically as well? So we have a project going on there. And in addition, on the public health side, we're looking at, and this is based on on case studies in states, how ACA and other developments in health policy are impacting public health, state and local health departments as well. A lot of concern in the public health community about how this all fits together and what should the role of public health be, and so on. So we're generating some studies and some original data there as well. And then I'll close. We're also asked to look at within the public health sphere, are there ways to improve the linkages between the public health community, so this would be the state and the local health departments, and the clinical and community, for greater potential for integration. So let me stop there, Larry. We'll talk later about the request from the department for the committee to consider designation as the review committee and ACA, but I think we've reserved time for that later.
We have questions for Jim. Obviously, nothing going on, no changes. Vicki.
First, your presentation, as usual, is exciting, particularly in terms of thinking about becoming a data center and also in terms of a lot of the alignment issues. One of the things I wanted to remind us about is that when we did the hearing on social economic status, we actually had, I think, several recommendations of ways to bring these, particularly the stat agencies, together to improve the data. So that, you know, may be there in the, you know, in thinking about some of the actions to take.
We actually, just quickly, we had a discussion at the Data Council, and it turned out for some of those demographic items, we're actually very close to a standard. There was a fair small amount of variation. Income was a little harder because some of these income levels are defined very specifically in the program. But I think on the other demographics, we sort of are very close in practice, as a practical matter, to having a standard, at least a conventional way to do those demographics. Some of the others where you're asking about risk behavior, smoking cessation, alcohol or substance abuse or things like that. Different people seem to ask that differently. But you could probably, I think there are recommendations for how you would do it depending on what you wanted to know.
I think I can speak for the whole committee. I suspect the whole committee would appreciate if you'd extend our welcome and to Secretary Brunwell.
Absolutely.
And to Richard Frank.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nice to have them aboard, have people mm-hmm. in those positions, and mm-hmm. wish them well for us.
Glad to have them come to a meeting. Say hello.
Okay. Yes,
just a quick comment. This is Walter. Just a quick comment. Is there an opportunity perhaps to have a meeting with the Secretary in terms of introducing NCHS to the Secretary?
I'm thinking of that, Walter. We're in the process now of setting up briefings on sort of everything she has to deal with in like 30 days. And we're thinking of having the committee, briefing her about the committee and have her come to another meeting, maybe have committee member chair visit her as well. So that's definitely in our plan. We just have to get on her,
sure,
on her calendar.
Sure.
So.
Thank you.
Matthew.
Thank you, full committee, for this opportunity to brief you. I'd like to give a pitch for the recruitment to the standard subcommittee that I yesterday was very exciting, I'd say. There were many debates and many controversies, and I think that's a good thing, right? I think it's excellent that we're hearing opposing sides and that we're hearing controversy because that means people care, and so it's a very exciting place to be and lots of exciting decisions to be made. So I would echo that it's a great place to get your feet wet. I would like to talk a little bit about leadership changes very quickly. Some of you met Todd Lawson yesterday. Todd is our new director of the Office of eHealth Standards and Services. He's replacing Rob DeGallicog, who's now at the department. I'm the acting deputy director under Todd, and most of you probably know Denicia Green. She's been kind of leading the ICD-10 charge for CMS and for the industry, and she's now the director of the Administrative Simplifications Group. So that's kind of like the new squad. I would like to say that, we heard a lot of good news and bad news yesterday. Some good news that we've been hearing about, a couple weeks ago, we had an e-health summit. CMS had an e-health summit. We've been having, this was the fourth, I think, over the past year and a half. And these are listening sessions where we invite industry representatives and associations in to talk about e-health issues. And this particular session, all-day sessions, probably four panels, I think. Most of them were on EHR, meaningful use, and quality issues. But there was one session on administrative simplification and operating rules, and we had two health plans and a provider, a hospital organization. And there was just some great anecdotes about the administrative savings for those particular entities that came about through the implementation of operating rules. So, for instance, one of the health plans talked about 2 years ago, they were seeing 90 million requests over a six-month period for eligibility requests. Now, the operating rules have since been put into place. That's doubled for them in the last 2 years to nearly 200 million. They said that a tremendous savings that they would not have been able to handle that kind of manual workload, 100 million eligibility, through the telephone. And the hospital kind of said the other end of that, which was they're doing many more eligibility requests, which kind of clears the pathway for a clean claim to make sure that a claim is paid, less denied claims. And they were able to take three or four of their personnel that are usually in administrative work and shift them to actually providing health care. So anecdotes, unfortunately, we don't have good data on more broader ROI across the industry, but this is the work of this committee. This is the work of the discussions and the controversies and the recommendations of the Secretary, so I think you all deserve a little pat on the back. The other thing, we talked about unintended consequences of regulations yesterday. An interesting unintended consequence of the EFT, so under the Affordable Care Act and under the recommendation from this committee, the healthcare payments we standardize the form and format in which a healthcare payment is paid electronically. We worked in coordination with NACHA, the financial institutions, it turns out that one of NACHA's rules, complementary rules that they added on to the operating rules, was that all health plans, all originators of health care payments, had to label their payments as health care payments. So now, as of January, we're getting a monthly report of the dollar amount and the number of health care payments that are made electronically on a monthly level. The numbers are staggering. I have no idea what to do with this data, but I'm in a room full of data wonks, so if anybody wants this. And what's interesting is the operating rules just went into effect in for NACHA in November and for HIPAA in January, and they've seen a 30% increase in healthcare EFT payments. Now, I was very excited when I first saw that because I'm not a data guy, because I thought, oh, this means 30% more providers are using EFT to pay. But no, it's really that 30% more are implementing the operating rules and are following the rules, right? Still, you can see that increase, and I think we're going to continue to see that increase. Again, some data that somebody out there has got to be interested in. Interesting numbers. I will talk a little bit, kind of summarize what Todd talked, gave a briefing on some of our admin SIM regulations and some of our work there. Certification of compliance, the proposed rule came out earlier this year. We thank the industry and you all for your comments on that. We expect a final rule later this year. ICD-10, as you're probably aware, April 1st, 2014, set the date back 1 year. HHS expects to release an interim final rule in the near future that will include a new compliance date that will require the use of ICD-10 beginning October 1st, 2015. It also clarifies that up until October 1st, 2015, ICD-9 will be continued to be used. Attachments, very interesting conversation about attachments. if you could follow what it was, we all learned the new word null flavor, which is triacting 31 flavors for that. It is our opinion, CMS and the Office of eHealth Standards and Service, that there's still significant work to be done in all standard areas related to clinical attachments, and we do not feel that an attachment standards, either on the messaging level, operating rules, or clinical documentation levels, are mature at this time or are ready for adoption as national standards for clinical attachments. We will continue to work with NCDHS and industry to achieve consensus on a national standard and utilize processes established by NCDHS and HHS regulatory processes at the appropriate time as we consider the adoption of an attachment standard. We said at the beginning of the day yesterday, and I think it kind of echoed where that conversation was during the day on attachments. Health plan ID, I think we might have heard a little bit about that. We are expanding our outreach and education to help health plans and other stakeholders think through those key concepts with HBID enumeration. We've hosted a number of webinars, developed frequently asked questions and blogs. We can say the same about the EFT issues that we talked about yesterday, that we believe our role is enforcement and education, and we'll continue to do that. Dr. Green talked, and I think it was circling all the conversations yesterday of that convergence between administrative data and clinical data. So one of OESS's other roles is the implementation of the meaningful use incentive payments for Medicare and Medicaid. We've got some hot off the presses statistics. As of June 1st, nearly 95% of eligible hospitals have registered for incentive payments through the Medicare or Medicaid incentive programs. 70% of all of those eligible hospitals have been paid something, have been paid incentives. 91% of eligible hospitals have been received payments. 70% of eligible professionals have registered for incentives, and about 70% of them have received incentive payments. And today, June 1st, nearly 400,000 eligible professionals have received incentive payments. Now, one of the more striking stats that came out yesterday was that only 8 eligible hospitals have attested to stage 2 at this time. And to that point, CMS and ONC, the Office of National Coordinator, are working on a rule. The proposed rule would let providers use the 2011 edition CERT or a combination of the 2011 and 2014 edition of the CERT for the EHR reporting period in 2014 for both Medicare and the Medicaid EHR incentive programs. The comment, so that rule came out May 23rd, 2014. Comment period for that rule closes July 1st, 2014. In addition, the other thing that OESS is working on is a proposed rule on stage 3 for meaningful use for the EHR incentive programs. That's currently under development. We're hoping publication is expected probably the fall of 2014. And good. That's it for me. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'll take any questions.
Linda.
In the interest of getting some metrics on the impact of the administrative simplification, would there be a possibility of quantifying the savings from that 30% and starting to trend that as a way of building the argument and the results of these changes? It seems to me that we could have a whole set of metrics from these new standards as they go into effect, and that could be useful.
Yeah, and I think the EFT is a good example of that. I would also point to CAQH, which took over the Healthcare Efficiency Index, and I'm not sure on the dates on that, but they're going to look very carefully at that electronic versus manual use of each of the transactions. And if we track that metric according to dates, I think that would be some very interesting data.
Something that the standards subcommittee could look into and see if we can't build a case to continue the momentum.
Justine.
And I think this is very, looking ahead to next year's report to Congress, I think this is a very important piece to begin to flesh out to tell the story. You know, when we did the 10th report, we talked about if only we could connect the dots. And I think this is one other piece that we've connected. And we should be able to demonstrate the tangible efficiency or, you know, return. But I think we should keep going on that theme in the report to Congress, that even though it takes a few years, connecting all the dots is going to get us there. And each year with this kind of progress, you know, all the hard work that was done when the ACA first came out is now really showing returns. And I think it would be a great segue from that report.
Thank you, Matthew. Judy?
I wanted to make sure that the committee had their chance to raise questions. I did want to point out one issue on the EFT, and it's just like a yellow flag. There's been a lingering question since, I think, 1996 about what rules actually apply to financial institutions when they're processing EFTs. And the more that they get involved in actually managing the data, the more questions it raises. And there's a carve-out under HIPAA, and there's been a long controversy over what that carve-out actually means and the extent to which financial institutions do or don't have to abide by some of the rules on use and disclosure. We've received some of these materials in through clearance, and we haven't skated right up to that line yet where it's going to become a real problem, but I just wanted to raise the issue that it's something that we need to be looking at in the future. You know, the issues, the things that have already come out, some of the things that have already been addressed in the EFT. So I just want to make sure that as we're moving forward, we keep that in mind. That I don't think that, Linda, you're shaking your head. That issue's never been resolved, has it? That's a no for those of our listening.
Is that an issue for this committee?
Well, so the emerging issue around the card, like
issue.
Virtual card, for example, I think talks to that very concerned because, you know, the industry is trying to monitor the adoption of it and try to understand if there are any abuses out there and excessive fee. And that's really, I think to your point, that's really between sort of financial institution, health plan providers, and trying to wrestle out, okay, who really is governing this, you know.
Justine,
I remember that we did talk about this in the hearings that summer, fall, winter, whatever it was, and we should look back to see what we said. But I agree. I think it is something that it fits very much with what we're already doing and what we have done.
Yeah, it's a great point. Yeah, I think I'm not sure that it has been resolved. I think there's a definite answer to it, but it is operationally functioning right now, and the concepts basically are, you know, if the financial institution is a routing mechanism, just like Verizon is routing all our electronic health records in exchanges, then it's a conduit in some ways. But in some instances, the financial institutions do capture and translate and transform some data potentially, and so there is questions about to what extent those financial institutions become in contact directly and manipulate or manage health information, and then where does it get maintained and who handles it and how it gets disclosed and are they business associates? All those questions become important. So, yes, that's a very good
point. Matthew?
So I think this is a very excellent point. You know, it falls under the rubric, and I forgot who termed it, medical banking. And it's worth having a whole session on medical banking because clearly the financial institutions are getting very involved in payment and billing and remittance. And you're right. We've actually kind of skirted around this one. We found with the EFT standard that it wasn't our problem yet because it was a very clear, this is payment information, and it fell in very clear lines. And I think we even said something that, you know, if a banking or entity or any entity acts like a clearinghouse and actually goes beyond that and generates the remittance advice or anything like that, then clearly they're a clearinghouse, and we didn't get much pushback on that. What's coming, though, is some of the more efficient kind of payment processes, like a standard which joins the payment and the remittance advice that you can shoot through the financial institutions at the same place, which will be tremendous efficiencies but brings up everything that you're talking about, which is then you're really having the banks. And Fedwire's got a standard that can do that. ACH, the NACHA, has a standard that can do that. So we're headed towards a place where that discussion absolutely has to take place.
Especially real issues today around health reimbursement accounts, for example. I don't think there's an efficient way of doing that today in the industry. You know, FSA, HSA, and HRA, especially HRA health reimbursement accounts, where that's where you see the joining of claims in financial, and typically it's handled by financial institutions. So, again, that's been around for years. It hasn't been resolved.
And I realize it doesn't connect directly, but got to deal with the information flowing through the health insurance exchanges and the adjudication of that and the verification of it. Non-HIPAA-covered entities. So this is really straightforward, really simple. No issues here.
This is something that actually maybe jointly we can work between the Privacy and Security Work Committee and standards.
Okay. Anything else? Judy, nice to see you.
Thank you. And following the vein of the simple and all those things, I'm going to cover the things that are on the screen right now. There's been lots of other things going on, of course, since we last met, but I thought these are the things that I would focus on. So talk a little bit more about the EHR adoption statistics, the vendor certification status, JSON report, PKS report, the interoperability report that was released just last week by ONC, the new Health IT dashboard following up on the open data initiatives, and then talk a little bit about our functional realignment within ONC. Oops. Yeah. I think I'm just going to lean over and do that. Oh, she'll do it for me. Thank you. Okay, so this is where we're standing. I've used this particular graphic before. On the left-hand side are the professionals. On the right-hand side are the eligible hospitals. Where we're at with the professionals right now in terms of those who have been paid, either from Medicare or Medicaid, is 70%. And these are the statistics as of the end of April. Okay? And then, again, up to 88% with those who are registered, with a denominator of about 537,000. And then on the right-hand side, total eligible hospitals, we've paid 91%, either through the Medicare or Medicaid or both. And the total number of hospitals registered, 4,727. So, again, the hospitals continue to do better in general than the professionals, but you're seeing clearly, I think, a good tipping point here. Okay, next slide. In terms of the dollars that are paid out, again, as of the end of April, we're up to $23.7 billion. So it's lots of money that has been paid out, and you can kind of see the month over month on here as well. This is an interesting graphic that was used yesterday at the policy committee that I thought might be interesting to those of you. And what's important here is actually the definition that you probably can't read at the bottom. But the categories are hierarchical and mutually exclusive, meaning if an eligible provider fits into one of the categories, they then are subsequently eliminated from the subsequent categories. So the dark blue, the 59%, have attested to meaningful use and received a payment. The next percentage, the 15%, have only done the AIU part or the Medicaid part, which is the adopt, implement, and upgrade. So that's where you're not actually demonstrating meaningful use, but you're on the journey. You have purchased an electronic health record, and you're in the throes of implementing or upgrading. Okay, so again, you can see this is a little bit of a different way of looking at just that simple threshold that was on the thermometer graphic before. And then that first orange, 17 more percent are registered for the EHR incentive program. And then we have a small slice that are not yet registered for the program, haven't been paid, but they're enrolled with a regional extension center. So the idea is they're at least interested and they're participating, okay? And so we only actually, and these are the professionals now, there's only 3% that are pretending this isn't happening. And so really I think this tells a different story than that 70% on the previous slide, in that there's a level of engagement here at different kinds of thresholds, if you will, but definitely everybody's got us in gun sights, us meaning the implementation of electronic health records. So if we go to the next one, I have absolutely no idea how you do this in Excel, but I was so intrigued by this graphic, I actually had to bring it here. This takes a while to digest, and I'm actually not going to go through the gory detail. I do believe we provide these slides to folks, right, so if they want to dig down later, yeah. But basically what this shows is those who attested in 2011, what happened to them in 2012, and then what happened to them in 2013. So when they dip down into the orange, they're actually leaving the program, but if they come back up into the green, they're coming back into the program, okay? And again, if anybody knows how to do this in Excel, let me know, and I'll give it to somebody else. but what's intriguing is we did have a dropout of folks in their attestation in 2012, but a good chunk of them actually came back. And so the percentage, there was 16 dropped out, but 7% of them came back in. And so, again, rest assured that we're tracking this for the purpose, really, of understanding where are the pain points and where are there issues that people don't understand or need help in the program itself. So, again, I love this graphic just to make sure that we're explaining that. This is exactly the same information that Matthew talked about. The only difference here is that in the little graphic, I hope you can read it, yeah, in the upper left-hand corner there, it shows week over week. And I think that's important because it's we're starting to see a trend. And this is those folks who have implemented 2014 certified electronic health record system code, okay? So the threshold was you have to at least get that code installed, and then this year using that for either stage one or stage two attestation. So the columns are broken out by the eligible professionals, stage one who are on that code, eligible professional stage two are on that code, and that's where that number 447 is an important one, because that's how many eligible professionals have actually already attested to stage two on new 2014 certified code. And if you look at the number right below that, 252, it actually in 1 week doubled. And so I hope this is a trend we're going to start to see, that folks are actually realizing that this is doable and accomplishable. And then the two columns for the eligible hospitals. Interestingly, the hospitals are not doing quite as well, and you see we're still dealing with a single-digit number when it comes to stage two. But I'm a little bit heartened that, you know, it went from 3, 4, 7, 7 to 8. Okay, I get excited about small things. On the right-hand side, again, it's just showing the graphic of that, the red being the eligible, the stage two, and the blue being the stage one. Do note that the scales are different in the two, so don't think that they're equal. Again, the hospitals are lagging behind. The scale is a much smaller scale. But again, I think we're seeing, some positive movement. Okay, in terms of certified products, if you go to the next slide, those that are certified for 2014, 940. So, again, we're getting the critical mass. There was a lag in actual vendor certification, but we're seeing a lot better. Kind of an interesting note on this, those eligible professionals at 447, we do know what vendors they actually are, and that data set is actually available for anybody to look at. We don't, per se, really advertise that on the ONC or CMS website, but we actually know that. And one of the things I will say about that is, interestingly, a lot of those early attesters are on cloud-based solutions. So they're on the newer technologies, those that have common code that's accessed wherever you happen to be using that electronic health record, as compared to kind of a traditional legacy model where, you know, you install the software in a local instance and use it. The different kinds of products that are available, especially for eligible professionals, I think it has really been a boon for the industry. So if we go to the next slide, 2011 certified products continue to be actually quite high, but I will remind you of a statistic, and I should have looked up the exact statistic, but it's in 30% of the products here that have never been used for attestation. So although we have a lot of products that got certified at 2011, some large percent of them actually have never been used for a provider, either a hospital or a professional, for attestation. Okay, if we go to the next slide, these were, these are my old slides. Do we have the new slides? Okay. If you have two of them from me.
That was an interesting slide.
Yeah. I'm looking at that going, no, that's not the right slide. I sent them, and I got confirmation that the new ones were going to be here. So sorry about that. All I was going to do actually was talk about that NPRM. Beth Myers from CMS yesterday at the policy committee had some interesting slides in terms of really differentiating the options that are available now for attestation at stage one and stage two. And if the NPRM goes through, there's three different sets of options, and it was a good way of clarifying. And I wanted to point you all to those slides and show you them. And if you can get the word out to point to those now, huh? Okay. if you all could point to those two, I think there's some confusion right now about what you really can and be allowed to do in 2014. But the long and the short of it is that NPRM talks about the fact that you do not now need to attest to stage two if you are having some issues with your vendor and getting your code installed. And so you actually have the capability of using the stage one certified code and actually selecting either the 2011 the stage one criteria or the stage two criteria. And we'll see if I can show that to you in a minute. Is that it? Oh, fabulous. You guys are great on that. Let's just go down real quick. One more, two more. Thank you. should be the next slide. That's it. Okay. And so, again, because lots of folks, I think, look to you to try to understand this, if this NPRM goes through, and again, I will remind everybody we're in the comment period right now, but if this NPRM goes through, if you could go to the next slide, for stage one, here are your options. This year, you can attest on 2011 code, you can attest on a combination of 2011 and 2014 code, or you can be on 2014 code. Okay, and it correspondingly then points out, and I think this is just a really helpful slide for folks to understand what are my options right now. And if you go to the next slide at stage two, you actually have some of the same options. Okay, so the barrier, if you will, that folks were concerned about was the ability to get their vendor code, and we're hoping that this NPRM, if it is approved and goes into regulation, that it would actually relieve some of that. Okay, so if we go to the next slide, these slides were also stolen shamelessly from the policy committee yesterday from John White. Jason reported, have folks heard about it? Okay, so I just wanted to kind of point you to it. I'm barely going to talk about it other than to say if this isn't on your radar, you might want it to be on your radar. It was a report that was sponsored by AHRQ in collaboration with ONC and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Jason is actually an independent scientific group that provides consulting services. And if you go to the next slide, I've just got a couple of key findings here. It's pretty much about the technology and interoperability, and I know that's been a word that we've talked about here quite a bit. And it talks about, if you go to the next slide, really a couple of, well, there's more recommendations than two, but here are the two, you know, key recommendations in terms of thinking about what ONC can do in terms of helping with an overall architecture and then moving the EHR vendors along. Now, this is particularly, I think, important because, you know, we talked about interoperability being a bit of a building block and, you know, having options. And this starts to talk a little bit more about defining the architecture more clearly and not, you know, letting a thousand flowers bloom, but creating a garden maybe with rose. And so, again, a very interesting report. And if you want to look on our website under the Federal Advisory Committees and the Health Information Technology Policy Committee, there's probably about 20 slides out there that John used yesterday. And the links to the reports as well as Karen DeSalvo's blog is listed there. All right. The other thing, there was a follow-up PCAST report to the one that was published in, go to the next slide, published in 2010. This came out in May. Again, the link is at the bottom here. And if we go to the next slide, I just pulled in one slide summary and conclusions in terms of this particular one is really about how we need to be looking toward systems engineering, and it's focusing on better care at lower cost, which is a theme those of you who follow the IOM reports certainly has been something we've been talking about since that IOM report in 2012. And so, again, in sake of time, this is more to pique your interest so that you go and look at the report if you haven't already. But it's much more digestible, actually, than the first one that came out in 2010. And if we go to the next slide, again, shameless advertising about a release of the ONC Vision for Interoperability. I have a link to both the report and Karen DeSalvo's blog about the report where she highlights, you know, why we're doing it. And, by the way, I know she's coming tomorrow. So this might be something, if you're having a dialogue, that you would want to ask her about. This is very near and dear to her heart. And within the report, and it's a fairly high level, and it's actually not all that long, but it sets out goals for 3, 6, and 10 years in this space of interoperability. Wanted to advertise the fact that the Health IT Dashboard has had a major renovation. There are all sorts of new pieces of information out there, again, along with the open data in government aspects. There's probably these tab things that you see there, those three. If you scroll down on this particular home page, there's probably 50 of those, and there's all different kinds of data briefs, different graphs, different data sets that you can download, different graphics of the United States where you can drill down by state and even by county in terms of the meaningful use data. So if you haven't spent some quality time on the dashboard site, you might want to do that as well. And I will wrap up then on my last slide Again, if you're following things that are going on in health IT, you probably know that we have had a restructuring over the last couple of months in terms of the Health IT Policy Committee and the Health IT Standards Committee and their work groups. So some have been sunset, some have been created, and some have been sort of repurposed. And there are a new set of them. There's 12 of them now, and some are crossed between the standards and the policy committee. So, again, I knew I wouldn't have time to go into the gory detail, but just to let you know that that did happen. And then also over the last couple of weeks, the ONC has had a realignment, a functional realignment, and a flattening, actually, of our organization, where we now have 11 offices, and all of those offices report directly to the immediate office, which is both Karen DeSalvo and Dr. Jacob Ryder. So, again, I didn't want to have a specific graphic related to that, but just know that that happened as well. And if you have questions about that, you can certainly ask Karen tomorrow.
Sally.
Thanks. This may be a question for Joy as well. But let me pose it to you. You mentioned the certified EHR providers, and a lot of the newer ones are cloud-based. And in my experience in dealing with other cloud services, the vendors will offer a variety of packages from the consumer to the enterprise to government. You get different controls in these different packages. And I'm wondering, have people looked at the kinds of controls with cloud-based services and given recommendations to the professionals or the hospitals purchasing them so that there's a standard well beyond what's required in HIPAA, like the detail in terms of what you need for security with cloud-based services, what is the minimum for, you know, in terms of a business associate agreement, but beyond that, what you have to look at when you make that purchase?
That is a really good question, and I will turf it to Joy, and I know she's looking at it.
Yes, cloud-based services are one of the things that are on our agenda, things to look at. There is not agreement as to the quote, best practices in looking at those items now. So it's not it's not one of those things that either OCR or ONC could just come up with a list. It is an item where there will need to be work done to gather information. As you know, HIPAA is scalable and flexible, and so it does allow some degree of range in those services. Most services recognize that if they if their name is on the front page of, I guess now it's not the New York Times, but it's the front page of Yahoo or something like that on the Internet for their data breaches, that's not a good thing. So there is a lot of awareness from many of these providers that they need to have very strong security pieces in place. Having said that, it would be very good for providers to have a little bit more information about at least what the questions they should be asking. As we've seen in much of our other security work, though, that work really needs to be done primarily by IT security specialists, because the providers, even if they ask those questions, won't necessarily know what the answers mean.
It's a complicated discussion, even around non-EHR products.
Yeah, can I echo that a little bit? The real challenge, and we're dealing with this today, is when you have commingled data set, when you have multi-tenant environment, and most of these EHR vendors, I believe, are multi-tenant. So when there's a breach, maybe you were going to go there. With the breach, you have to basically be transparent. Now, the challenge is when you're in a multi-tenant environment, you don't really know where the breach occurred. And let's say you have 100 practices sharing that environment. Does that mean all the 100 entities have to announce that there was a breach, and how you hone in? But that's some of the sort of gray areas that everybody's struggling with.
I will, of course, get into this during my discussion, but it's so important to move past the risk analysis, the simple documentation of potential threat and risk using something like a cloud server, to actually going forward with the risk management. And what we're seeing is a bit of a disconnect when we do go out and audit or we do go out and investigate, many covered entities have taken the steps to document what the potential risk is, but have not gone ahead and executed on those threats and hazards. So really, it's risk management is just critical.
Justine?
A minor point, but in my own personal day job, your jump up on hospitals on meaningful use is probably going to jump up in about 2.5 weeks because you had to wait for delivery of the software and then your 90 days. So you can count on at least 6 coming up.
So for those of you who aren't tracking that, we're moving into the last quarter and that you have to do a quarter's worth or 3 months, 90 days of a measurement. And so that's what she's alluding to.
Yeah, yeah. Four more coming.
There you go.
Double digits.
Are the comments well on? Okay.
Oh, me. No, they're off. A great summary. Thank you. One question that has always been in my mind about providers, eligible professionals, is that in this country we have about 1.3 million physicians when it comes to licensed practitioners. And, you know, when you take out, and this is true, many physicians actually passed away and they still have their license active by the family. So when you take out that and you take out a number of other duplicates perhaps and certain specialties that clearly, you know, maybe are not eligible, you know, maybe cosmetic surgeons or something like that, we still are like about 500,000 physicians below the when it comes to your max of eligible physicians of 537,000, you know, where is the hole in the rest of the physicians in this country in terms of being eligible to participate?
Yeah. So we get those numbers actually from CMS, and I'm not trying to just say I don't know, but I don't. And I mean, a good chunk of it is related to the thresholds that have to be met for the Medicaid or Medicaid participation. And but that wouldn't account, I don't think, for all of them. But I suppose if you add that with the specialists and everything, we painstakingly come up with that 537,000 number, and it varies. Of course, it changes dynamically, you know, month over month when this data comes out. But it's pretty much based on data that we get from CMS.
Okay. Let's do the CART 10 setter up, and then let's keep the transition going over to Joy. Raj?
I see a lot of labs, and you said only 3% think that they're not aware of what's going on. But I think these 3% are the smart physicians who refuse to take the payments and refuse to see Medicare patients because the cost involved in implementing these EHRs is so expensive that they're willing to afford the penalties that they can pay rather than indulge in the cost. I think you'll see a trend more of physicians falling out of the CMS data because more and more physicians I talk to in the community feel the onerous, meaningful use to requirements. They're taking the incentive payments for meaningful one use, but they're saying, no way they're going to go to the meaningful two because the vendors are imposing such prohibitive costs on them that they cannot afford it. Unless the government incurs more money into them, I think you'll see more of these positions falling out. You showed only 16% falling out and 9% coming back, but you'll see when meaningful use two comes into play, there'll be more dropout. And a lot of patients, physicians of mine are refusing to take, I mean, especially independent providers, people who are part of a hospital chain or a large group, they're willing to afford that because their companies are afforded. But individual practitioners are dropping out.
I just noticed, Raj, that Alex and others, you may want to sculpt this and correct this. but it became apparent in yesterday's meeting that there's a real credibility issue. That came up over and over again. The icing on the cake was the ICD-10 delay and the cost associated with that, both directions. But also around this upswing of adoption of the meaningful use EHR things, oh, now we've got it. And then this intense disappointment about what that EHR can actually do that helps clinicians practice medicine. So I think we need to heed your on-the-ground sense here about these statistics may not be all that they appear to be, and that there very well may be some interesting times around the corner. I'm sorry to mouth off, Jonathan.
So I actually let a detail slip out of my head. The mid-teens chunk of eligible providers that had achieved AIU, have they received a payment as well?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I thought so, but I just wasn't totally sure. Okay, that's it. Thanks.
So I just want to comment on the comment because, you know, I think somehow meaningful use became like the end, you know, rather than the means to an end. And just to reemphasize that, you know, that program wasn't meant to be, boy, if you meet meaningful use, you're done and done and your life is good for the next 20 years. It was really more to get the infrastructure in so that we could do the things that you all were talking about at the beginning of the meeting, right? So it's the floor and what we need to have in place so that we can do the analytics, so that we can understand best practice, so that we can become a learning health system. So no matter what happens to the meaningful use program, I certainly hope that we don't lose track of the fact of what automation can do for us and even think about going back to the paper record kinds of things. And that's why if we could separate that conversation in our heads from the meaningful use program to automation of healthcare and why we need to do that. They're not mutually exclusive, okay, they overlap, but this is where we need to be going.
That's well said. Don't you think there's parallel process with the redesign of primary care practices? PCMH standards suddenly became the end in themselves, and there were practices that could get a check mark in all the boxes, but they still practiced medicine the same way, and they weren't transformed. And there's parallels there.
Exactly. That's a really good one.
But it's really about building the infrastructure and the payment models, the information models, and the design. It's a transformation that we're after here. Yes, Jim.
I want to propose a slightly different way of categorizing this issue. There are some number, and I think it'd be neat to know what the number is. I've never seen it, and maybe nobody knows it. There's a certain number of eligible providers for whom the new world was never a smart business proposition and could not be made a smart business proposition. And those people, if they're smart business people, will practice the way they practiced 10 years ago or 15 years ago,
30 years
until
ago.
It becomes untenable and they retire. And that's just what they are. There's everybody else who is younger and so can't, you know, you could probably string this out, what do you think, Judy, 10, 15 years?
Absolutely.
Something like that. But if you can't retire in 15 years, then you've got to live in the new world. Or, as we said, if you work for an organization which is becoming, again, I don't know what the percentage is, but it would be useful to know, the dominant model, which is a large practice and integrated delivery network, some kind of very large organization for whom automation isn't the right term, but sophisticated information systems and thoroughgoing process redesign and a whole set of things that go way beyond EHR that are expensive, pay for themselves, but only pay for themselves at large scale. That's the question, I think, is how many people do we lose how fast because they have made a rational choice and said, I'm going to do it the old way until I can't do it anymore. and what does that do to workforce? What does that do to access? And then how rapidly is all the rest of the world becoming an employee of one of these large organizations for whom this is all just ho-hum? It's like voice. I mean, you have telephones. Nobody gets all hysterical about are we going to have phones or not. You expect them to work, and you expect them to be cheap.
Leslie, last word here.
Yeah, so this is a question about the NPRM. What are we losing by allowing the flexibility of the different 2011 combo or 2014? Is this another example of, well, people are having a hard time getting where they need to be, so we're really just putting things off again, but paying people anyway?
Yes. The biggest difference between stage one and stage two is in the space of interoperability. And both in transition of care documents being exchanged between providers and in the ability to view, download, and transmit from providers to patients. And those are the ones that the providers are having the hardest time achieving. So that's what we're losing.
So we're losing, the 2011 folks won't have that.
Correct.
Thank you.
Jim.
For a counterposition, I say, no, we're not losing anything. All of this did its intended job, which was to get all of this started. What is going to drive this forward now is market demand. That there are big organizations with thousands of locations around the country who are getting killed by the cost of interoperability that is now just handwork. And that is a huge market opportunity worth billions of dollars, and it will be solved by the market. And, you know, standards can be usefully created to make this faster and smoother, but I don't think we're losing anything.
Thank you. So, Joy and Rachel, what I'd like to do is to do both of your presentations one right after another and see if we can build a wall around this committee to not pepper Joy with questions so we'd be sure we hear, and then we'll pepper you with questions together.
Okay. Given the time constraints we have, I'm going to try to give you a very brief overview of the status of what we've been calling data segmentation for privacy initiative. With this time limit, I know we have a number of new members on the committee. How many are familiar with the background of this, or should I do a literally 1 minute?
Do 1 minute.
Do 1 minute. Okay.
Take the time you need to do your presentation.
All right. Well, okay.
This is really important.
Okay. Then we'll get you the longer version. So before I get into the details, I'd like to do a little context setting. This is the ability to share information and what choices patients might have with sharing that information and how technically you're going to be able to do that has been on the table before this committee since I think I got involved with this committee back in the day, about 2000. So it's been around a long time, and it's a very knotty issue. As you all know, under the HIPAA privacy rule, providers may use and disclose information for certain core purposes, such as treatment, payment, and healthcare operations, without the individual's express consent. That alone was controversial when the rule was written. HIPAA also statutorily, under the statute, HIPAA establishes the framework for how federal law interplays with state law, happens. And under the statute and the rules, HIPAA says that laws that are more privacy protective for health information remain in place. What that means is that if you have state laws or federal laws that actually give patients the ability to or require that the patient's consent or express permission be provided before their health information is exchanged, those rules remain in place. So where we are right now is we have HIPAA as it was intended to be the baseline of privacy protections across the nation. We have many state laws that this committee has reviewed in the past that provide additional protection because they require patient permission to exchange certain types of information, many of which would fall into what people call, and I'm going to put this in quotations, sensitive information, because we all know that varies from individual to individual. There are also a few federal laws that protect certain types of information. One of the primary ones are the laws, the regulation, the statute and the regulations that protect the confidentiality of information that's generated by certain types of behavioral health care providers, in particular those who provide substance abuse treatment. An issue which I would note for those of you who read the paper closely has really come back to the forefront in the last year with all of the increasing use of heroin. That itself is a fascinating issue. But the requirement and exists at the statutory level for in the federal realm for patients to be able to give their express consent to share their substance abuse treatment information. And if they give that consent, the protection of that information flows with the information, and there is a notice that must be given along with that information that the recipient can't redisclose it without the patient's permission. This, there are many other many state laws that are very similarly structured. So it's protection pretty much follows the information, and the and the provider has to give notice of how to do that. The issue that we have seen developing is that as health information exchange is taking off, that the information that's being generated, particularly by behavioral health care providers and other providers who focus on these, quote, sensitive health information, is being excluded from the systems because as a tactical matter, it has in the past been somewhat difficult in order to do this. We had a hearing back in 2010. Before the HIT Policy Committee, where we had a number of different organizations that that mask or protect data along these lines come in and tell us what they were doing. So there were some, back in 2010 even, there were some institutions that were using technology. It wasn't aligned. There weren't standards. We heard from the Policy Committee that we, ONC, needed to do more work on policies and standards. So that's what we did, and we've been focusing on the technology primarily because there are existing and not the policy. The reason we're doing that has been a very, it is very intentional because what we're trying to do is ensure that that providers are able to implement these existing legal requirements in an electronic environment. We've been focusing and our data segment, this has been called, the term has come out, data segmentation for privacy. I did not invent that term, just so you know, because I know people don't know exactly what it means, but the idea is that you could send some health information, but not all health information related to a patient. We've been focusing in our technical efforts on this, primarily on substance abuse and behavioral health for two reasons. First is there's a very clear intent from this administration to enable the integration of behavioral health care information more in primary care, and we recognize that. And the other one is a more practical consideration, but also I think a very important one, which is one of the reasons that we are encouraging the adoption of electronic health information technology is to help reduce costs. And we really, when you're looking forward, can you really afford, you have to ask yourself, can you really afford to exclude the 20% of the market that many people say is responsible for about 80% of the cost from health information exchange? Given that, we've been working on developing, the data segmentation for privacy, we initiated the data segmentation for privacy initiative in the standards and interoperability framework It would take me an hour to go through the whole history of what everything we've done. But the long and the short of it is where we are now is that after having a public-private initiative where the private sector really drove what they wanted to address, how to address it, and what standards existed and how they needed to be massaged in order to work better together, this is where we are. The initiative has pretty much come to an end. They developed a set of standards, and what they do is they tag data. In the pilots that were conducted, it was done at the document level, and they focused on using the CDA document because that is a document that is very integral to achieving meaningful use. The codes, there are three major types of metadata that are associated with this, and I am not the technical expert on this, so if you're getting that far down into the weeds, we'll have to get somebody else to help you out with technically how they accomplish this. But the confidentiality codes convey the how the information has to be handled. And it's at a very high level, they didn't want to disclose this is HIV information or this is substance abuse information on the outside of the document. So it says this document is restricted or it's not restricted or it's very restricted. So it's kind of a generic coding so that it can be used across multiple types of information. It has a section of it for purpose of use, say treatment, emergency treatment, and obligations, including do not redisclose without consent. So the pilots utilize these standards, and they finesse them. And at the end of the project, the information, the results of the pilots was fed into HL7 and IHE, both of which are standard-setting organizations. And HL7 has developed an implementation guide for these. These are the detailed standards that have been incorporated as part of data segmentation for privacy for those of you who are technical. In essence, though, where we are right now is these standards, they were tested, they were piloted, the implementation guide was revised a couple of times, and so they are now what they call normative standards, which means they were voted on by the standard-setting organization, they were approved at the highest level, and just last month they were approved by ANSI as an accepted standard. So we have the standards in place. The standards that the standard-setting organization set, I will note, go beyond what were used in the pilot. They actually facilitate tagging at the document and section, but at both the document and the section level, and which is it's good because it's flexible. It is something that is beyond what was tested really in our pilot. So that's where we are I want to tell you a little bit about the pilot so you know how these were used. And I'm going to focus on two. We had six. I'm only going to focus on two given our time. One of these was the NetSmart pilot, which was undertaken in Florida. And what it did is they worked with a lot of behavioral health care providers to do transition of care documents to community care providers or community network services. So they have a 211 system there where they'll refer somebody for housing maybe or for other kinds of services. So they were transmitting information from a behavioral care healthcare provider to somebody outside of that system and were able to do that with the data tagged as required by law when they sent it. They reported at the policy committee hearing out on their pilot accomplishments that the hospitals that utilized the system actually saved millions of dollars because they were able to get the records electronically to the community health centers two weeks quicker than they were doing in a paper format. So they're live. They're not pilot. They are, they've implemented, they are using this in their day-to-day business right now. There was also a VA SAMHSA pilot. The primary piece I'd like to point out here is that they are already moving on to the fire standards. So they're looking forward. These were fires of using different ways of sending the information, making sure that this works not only through a direct exchange, but also through the direct protocol, the other types of protocol. To show the industry reaction, we've had at least one major vendor that purchased one of the pilots during this process, and they've reported that the behavioral health solution has data segmentation for privacy using Direct incorporated into production for spring this year, and they're moving to be able to share that information with their hospital, what they call their hospital solution, their Cerner Millennium solution, later this year. Now, so that's where we are with the pilot. So the next step we have is that the policy, this issue has come up before the policy committee because we now have some standards. We now have some testing and pilots that have been accomplished. And the ONC, as you all know, is contemplating expanding its certification program to voluntary certification for EHRs for behavioral health and long-term and acute care. And, of course, there are the aim of this is promoting exchange of data with primary care providers. And for behavioral health certification, the question came up of they were looking at the different components that might be required for certification, and, of course, data segmentation came up as to should you require this for certification of an EHR product that you're going to be pretty much marketing. People would be marketing to behavioral health care providers. And the answer, the long and short answer is yes, but. So the policy, the Tiger team, the Privacy and Security Tiger team, actually put a ton of thought into this. And they came up with a glide path for how they thought this should be approached. They thought that there needs to be two components. You need to look at not only the behavioral health care component, but also the general EHR component to make sure that the recipient would be able to use the information when they received it. And as you can see from this chart, which is we have copies of which are much easier to read, they have listed everything from level 0 to 3 where they think that we need to head on this. And they see as the initial step on this that including level 1 for meaningful use. These were recommendations that were presented to the policy committee yesterday, so they're brand new. I won't go into all the details because of time, but they are included in these guides. They're in these slides. I'm sorry, but overall, I would say that they. Item that should be of most interest to you is that they've made the recommendation. They think this is the direction we should be headed, and that it will next go to the standards committee for assessment as to whether these standards are ready.
Thank you, Joy. Let's keep going with Rachel.
We'll
plan on taking our break at 11 and between 11 and 11:15. We'll still preserve an hour for the HIPAA report.
Thank you.
Interoperability.
Yeah. So before I get started, I should mention that we've had some significant change at OCR. Our longtime Deputy Director for Health Information Privacy, Susan McAndrew, retired at the beginning of May. Christina Hyde, who is our senior advisor for health information privacy policy, is acting for her. So has both jobs right now. And work continues, as always. Today we've publicly released our 2011-2012 reports to Congress. As you may know, these are both required under HITECH. One of these focuses on breach notification, and the other focuses on the status of compliance with the HIPAA privacy, security, and breach notification rules. Very, very busy with respect to compliance and enforcement. We now have 21 settled agreements that include very detailed corrective action plans as well as monetary settlements, and one case that has resolved with a CMP. As of yesterday, we have well over 1,000 breach reports affecting 500 or more individuals, with 116,000 reports of breaches affecting fewer than 500 people. And I'll talk about audit just a little bit more in a few slides, but as you know, we've completed phase one of our audit program, and now we're in the planning stages of phase two, and we do have a notice out through the Federal Register that we of our intent to survey covered entities and business associates regarding the next phase of the audit program. So, recent enforcement highlights. There are over $8 million worth of them. New York Presbyterian and Columbia University most recently. This is really one of those joint relationships that we were talking about earlier, where we have a teaching hospital as well as a medical school with a teaching hospital associated with it, two different entities that share the same network. And we had a employee here of Columbia University, a physician who was standing, an app developer, who attached a rogue server onto the network of New York Presbyterian. Both covered entities knew that this was a very high-profile project. Both covered entities knew that this rogue server existed, had documented in their risk analysis the potential risk of a server attaching onto a network and didn't do anything about it. And then there was an incident and a disclosure of information of patients where those patients' information was publicly accessible on the Internet on any search browser. So this resulted in a $3.3 million monetary settlement for New York Presbyterian, $1.5 million settlement for Columbia University. This is our highest HIPAA enforcement action to date. And then I'm going to, for the purposes of time, I'm going to skip down to Concentra. This is a large covered entity that has a number of different healthcare functions that they perform throughout the country. Here we had a stolen laptop that was unencrypted. It's just the basics of what we continue to see all over. This laptop was left visible in the employee's car who went into a sports bar and came out, and lo and behold, the laptop was gone. So while we did receive a breach report on this was the second breach report affecting greater than 500 individuals for Concentra, and there were 16 breach reports affecting fewer than 500 individuals for Concentra. So they were what we call a frequent flyer, and we went out and conducted a compliance review on this entity. And, again, this resulted in over $1.7 million monetary settlement and corrective action plan.
We can fly to that bar?
And in fact, you know, our regional offices are very aware of who these frequent flyers are. We see them a lot. We do actively look at these breaches that come in annually affecting over 500 individuals and multiple breach reports coming in for the same entity. So, you know, what we're really seeing through audit and through these enforcement investigations are a pattern. Lack of risk analysis and risk management. The risk analysis might have been done in 2005, but it's never been followed up upon. There are no new policies and procedures when new mobile devices, for instance, are implemented. Then we also see a lack of security and control on portable devices. These are the unencrypted laptops, the stolen mobile devices, the tablets. Proper disposal continues to be a major issue for us. And my inbox is blowing up right now with press queries. Spring cleaning just happened, evidently, and people are going out to dumpsters to dispose at recycling centers to dispose of whatever they've got. They look inside, and what do they see? Thousands of medical records. And this is like an epidemic right now across the country. So, again, a lack of proper disposal of medical records, lack of access control, simple lack of training of staff, lack of understanding of the rules, lack of senior leadership attention to those rules, and an overall lack of a culture of compliance. So audit, what's to come? More robust enforcement and audits coming from OCR. We are in the process right now of revising our audit protocols to reflect the changes from the omnibus rule. And then you can expect to see business associates being included in our next round of audits. And, again, this is a process that is very much in development. So what's OCR doing to try to educate the covered entity and business associate community about their obligations? I had thought that ONC was going to give an update on the security risk assessment tool that they released a couple of weeks ago. It's outstanding. And we work together collaboratively on it, but it definitely is a good refresher for covered entities who are looking to dust off their initial risk analysis, or perhaps they've never conducted a risk analysis. It's a great place to start. We also work collaboratively with CMS to develop a new Medscape module. This brings us to 6. This is on EHRs and HIPAA, steps for maintaining privacy and security of patient information. I wish that Leon looked happier there, but perhaps it gives you an idea of the fact that we go on and on talking about this, but in the first month of its launch, we had over 13,000 learners with close to 5,000 test takers. That's in a month. And overall, these modules have had almost 140,000 learners with about 40,000 test takers. So they really are doing quite well. And for the sake of time, I think I'm going to wrap up. I know there'll be lots of questions for Joy.
Okay, we're going that way, guys, so just keep passing it to the right.
Just real quick, Rachel, since you talked about the changes to the rule, the disclosure rule, we just talked a little bit about cloud-based solutions, and there's more of those out there now, and that's going to be, certified. So is there going to be changes around the process of breach disclosure when it comes to, off-prem multi-tenant? Because I'm not sure these vendors are ready for any of those.
Well, even when we began to roll out as a department enforcement of the HIPAA privacy and security rules, we really did so in a phased approach. Trying to bring about voluntary compliance through technical assistance. And I think cloud is really the new frontier, and it's going to take some time for those vendors to understand their obligations under the rules and also for covered entities to work with their business associates and the vendors downstream on these obligations. And we are working in collaboration with NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology. And I should mention that towards the end of October, we'll be hosting our annual cybersecurity conference with them here in D.C. So I anticipate that more guidance will come on this issue, but you know, I do think that we take a very when it comes to enforcement, we're really looking to the basics of the rules right now. And many of, I would say, the majority of our last enforcement actions that have risen to the level of a monetary settlement have all focused on this lack of the basic risk analysis and the lack of risk management processes, the lack of policies and procedures, you know, especially with stage two meaningful use. In order to attest to, it's so important to have these basics in place and have it be a regular part of the organization's activities. So you're not just having your binders up on the shelf, that it's really part of the process and part of conversations that you're regularly having with your vendors.
Yeah, well, a quick question, too, for each of you. So, Joy, I've certainly have been involved with the S4P, and to me, this is one component of a larger contextual element or domain, which in my mind is the whole spectrum of e-consent in general. And it deals with how to not just consent for disclosure than generally or specific in specific states, but also to do more granular things like segmentation. So could you say a few words about where things are with respect to that? And then also one of the interesting things about data segmentation for privacy is, of course, it highlights the current need with a specific federal regulation, 42 CFR Part 2. When it comes to others, like more state regulations, when one has to do some specific consent, and then that data has been consentedly disclosed but only for certain purposes, when you give it to another provider in another state, that other provider in that other state is subject to other, perhaps less stringent laws, and so that other provider might not acknowledge or necessarily abide by this requirement at the first state, the original state. So could you talk a little more about the e-consent concept, just general, largely?
So we recognize that you can't – what many people are doing with respect to consent now is essentially faxing or using a computer to essentially fax, electronically send a PDF of a consent form, and that's just not sustainable in the long term. We recognized this issue a while ago, and we conducted a pilot, an initial pilot with the Western District of New York, looking at some means for capturing consent electronically and sharing it, and that material is available on our website. We also recognize that there are a lot of different mechanisms out there right now for capturing consent, some of them of which are electronic and some of which aren't. So we are committed to looking at consent from a technological perspective in this upcoming year and exploring it more. The way we normally run most of our work in my office is we do a landscape analysis first to see what the current state is, where there are issues, what people are doing, and where we think that the most work needs to be done. And that's not something that we can do alone. We need to talk to a lot of people in order to assess that. So that's where we pretty much are with that. We have looked at it. ONC's looked at that e-consent issue, as you know, in the past. at state level, doing a lot of pilots and things of that sort to see things that work with people, things that don't. Because one of the key components of that is making sure the individual actually understands what it is that they're consenting to. So education, we see education as being an integral part of that whole process. So, yes, we do see this. I'm glad you mentioned that, Walter, that the work that we've been doing on this is just really part of our greater, all the work that we're doing in consent. There are a lot of issues that exist with respect to this. I know that there has been a lot of pressure from some to change all these state laws, and where we are with that issue is that when the Congress considered changing the preemption framework in high tech, which was in 2009, it expressly came out and said, we're not changing that. So I'd like to tell people that we could make progress or we can spend all of our time fighting about that issue because it is where it is now, and we're trying to operate still within those confines.
Linda?
Quickly to Rachel, actually, this is a very quick question, hopefully, or it could be a long. Could you give us a status of the accounting of disclosures?
I don't have an update at this time.
Thank you.
Mine is more of a statement, and just to say that this is an advertisement for the full committee. We've asked Walter to help us follow up on this topic of data segmentation at this afternoon's breakout meeting for PCS because we want to delve a little deeper into it and really ask the question whether there's any work that that our committee might do on this, having looked at the sensitive data issue in the past and now kind of looking at what are the stewardship issues beyond HIPAA for some of the community uses of data because these issues are highly relevant. So we are going to spend more time on this topic today.
Could I just add to that for new committee members? We went through a very long, laborious process crafting a data segmentation letter that really focused on the legal requirements and that I think was a very helpful early document in getting this. And it's very nice to see what developments have followed.
It is. Alex, did you miss your...
Walter, you're spot on in talking about the larger e-consent issue, and that's why I started to put my card down. You know, coming from a state perspective where our provider community wants us to become HIPAA-aligned, our state has some more stringent rules than the federal rules, but the federal rules still play, but yet the HIT Policy and Standards Committee is really focused on rules related to EHRs for Medicare and Medicaid, we still have a huge gap, an issue that needs to be solved in respecting the diversity of citizen opinions about data sharing and enabling good quality outcomes. And this is a huge issue, and it's a painful one.
It is.
I'll stop there.
Justine, and then we'll come back and end with Jim.
I echo that. Two questions. One is, do you have an inventory of what these state rules are? And secondly, in your pilots, is there an assessment of the utility of the clinical information once it has been filtered through the segmentation as required both by federal and state rules?
So I'm going to answer the last question first because it's shorter. When you look at this chart that they have in here about the stages 0 through 3, they're really only at stage 1, which is what they were doing and did find useful, was to just send a CDA document in a document form that was tagged very high level, which they dealt with partners that they were very confident would know how to handle the information, and they did not incorporate that information into an EHR. There is a long discussion of that in one of the Health IT Policy Committee work groups. We had probably 9 to 10 hours discussion on this, and that is one of the things that informed the approach that they took. So that was taken into consideration in the recommendations that our policy committee, our privacy and security work group made to the policy committee, and that they adopted. So yes, they're aware of that issue, and they were looking at that issue, and that's why they're taking very small steps. But having said that, they also recognize that this was very useful for the people who work in this area to get that first step of getting that information in an electronic form to the people who needed it as quickly as possible. Do we have a list of all the state laws? Yes and no. One of the important things to recognize is states, just like the federal government, regulate in a very sector-specific way. So they have different, and I know this very painfully because I've conducted this survey about two or three times now before I ever got to ONC. So they have different laws that, and regulations that apply to MDs, to hospitals. Depending on what state you're in, you could have a different regulation that applies to just about every different kind of health care provider because most of these rules are under the licensing laws. So there is still on our website a survey that I did when I was at Georgetown in, I think, 2009 that focused on medical doctors and hospitals, and I think there might have been one other category because that was the only way to scope it and actually make any progress, and dealt with some of the major categories of information. It's a very complex area because some of it isn't in licensing laws. Some of it's under the public health laws. It's very difficult to even know where to find this information sometimes. So,
Joy, shouldn't we be able to get that information from all the HIE cooperative agreement reports since we had to all track to the National Framework for Privacy and Security? I mean, having led the initiative for Pennsylvania, we had to dive deep into that and use the great tools from HISBIC to do it.
I would say that there is variability in the reporting on that.
Yes. Jim, send us off to a break.
Okay. Thank you for all that you've done so far, and keep at it. I mean, we all know how difficult it is, and we appreciate it. It's just the asynchrony as you move to quick, get meaningful use too. You know, you can find yourself at an intersection of this topic that you were talking about today. I'll leave it at that.
So, Rachel, thanks for your report and the great work. One of the fundamental, maybe the fundamental issue in this is not ignorance, it's not lack of training, it's not that this is complicated, it's that it costs money to do it right. And you're doing a great job, but you can only do so much to make the cost of not doing it right closer to the cost of doing it right. And I just wonder if it's the committee's role, do you think about any other ways that we could create incentives or disincentives for doing this right? Could there be a voluntary association of high reliability care delivery organizations who would say these are best practices and we commit ourselves publicly to follow it? And are there other things? Could JC do anything? Could payers have any role in providing incentives for organizations that protect security? So I think if it were part of our role at all, I think it would be useful for someone to try to think of the other parts of this besides the one thing that can never do enough to make it expensive enough.
Leslie, you get the last word.
So this is a related question. Is there any work going on about sharing civil monetary penalties with people who've been harmed?
Yes, and that's in the statute, and currently we are working on a process for how to make that happen.
Would there be any interest in having any help from us?
I can certainly take that back and get back to you.
Sounds good. Matthew, Judy, and Extensio, Joy, and Rachel, thank you very, very much. Really great. So Walter and Ob will reconvene us in 9 minutes. Oh. Okay, we're going to reconvene, and we're going to start with maybe we'll see the head count after before we break for lunch.
Okay.
Get everybody in the room.
We should take a vote right now.
There you go.
You can go on. We're going to count later.
Your contract.
No, we're not going to do that right now. Okay. Exactly.
We do, but you're good at that.
Yeah. Do we have any new attendees on the phone? Okay. Walter.
Thank you. Well, it's
microphone.
I suppose the first thing I should say is that we're very excited that HHS now has a HHS visitor Wi-Fi. So anybody that wants to join the Wi-Fi world, you can click there and go to the various networks that you can see, and one of them is going to be called HHS-Visitor,
mm-hmm.
And you can log in. I mean, not log in. There's no password. There's no anything. It's just a protected, secure access to the Internet. So
it's a little thing.
So what?
It's a little thing.
Yeah. So we're back in the 21st century here.
Back in, that's right. Well, we're back in the 20th. We're almost in the 21st.
So very, very excited to present to you all the work that has been done. I went back, actually, and checked when was the first time that we presented the outline of the draft of this report, and it was on September the 3rd of last year. Our September meeting is when we introduced to the full committee our draft of the outline of what would be the HIPAA report, the 11th HIPAA report to Congress. And since then, there's been a flurry of activity over the last 9-10 months up to the point today. So just very briefly to review the process, we created that outline. We started to work with the subcommittee on the content. At the, probably the November meeting, the full committee decided that this was really going to be a full, of course, a report from the committee, and so we needed engagement of the other subcommittee. So we actually have dedicated sections for not just the administrative part of HIPAA, if you will, since this is a HIPAA report to Congress, but also the privacy and security. And then we added a special section on, standards and public health and population health. So we really have a reflection of our three major components of work of the full committee into the report. From there, from November up until, today, the three subcommittees have been working diligently in developing the different sections of the report. Going through many different iterations of drafts, all of the drafts compiled into one single report, and then distributed that to the entire committee for additional feedback, and received a lot of very incredible feedback in terms of detailed edits and corrections. And we still have a few more of items to adjust in the report. But overall, I think we have in front of you all a very amazing report, really. I do want to acknowledge, first of all, the person that is sitting to my right. Terry has been our lead staff since November, I believe it was, when you joined us, or December?
November, I started.
Did you join us in February this year?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So Terry just joined us not too long ago, and sort of we wanted to immerse her into the work of the subcommittee with a little project called the HIPAA Report to Congress.
There you go.
So she took on, and she is really the at the heart of this report. She put all these things that we were sending her in terms of content and elements into a very very easy to walk through and filled with references, actually, when you think about all the specific citations of specific things that we wanted to mention. They're all there as references. So this is actually another one of those reports that can be published as a book, really. So in any case, we posted the final draft of the report in the NCBHS website, and I'm actually going on our web, actually, to open it. And this is the report that you all have seen. This is a clean copy of the latest version of our report. I'm going to just walk through a couple of things. Of course, we in the report we have our standard cover, and our cover letter is from our chair, Larry, to the Speaker of the House. But the report goes to the various committees named, both in the Senate and the House, named in the legislation to be submitted to this, that should receive this report. We have a page, of course, of sort of the reference about the National Committee and the members of the National Committee, and then an Appendix C, we have a full roster of the National Committee members. And then the table content. So really, just to remind you, refresh you, you're perfect on this, we have four major sections, five major sections. So we have an executive summary, which we have shortened quite a bit. I mean, that's a good thing. We started with a very long, you know, multi-page or probably 22 pages executive summary. And so now we're down to really 8 pages of executive summary, which what we felt was that the report itself, the part that everybody's going to read, is executive summary. And the full report is going to be sort of a detailed description of all the things in the executive summary. And so that's really the context. The executive summary ideally is one page long or two at the most and bulleted. In this case, the executive summary becomes more of the actual report, if you will, and then the rest of the report is really the details. The main sections are administrative simplification, and we framed the report in 2012 and 2013. So by December of 2013 is what we were reporting. Things that happen after December 2013, you know, we try to avoid putting a lot into it. But there were two major things that we wanted to bring into this because some of them happened, one of them happened actually just before December 31st of 2013, and the other one was significant enough to really reference it, at least as an editor's note. The two things were, number one, the public health hearing that we had in November, which produced the letter that we will be reviewing and hopefully approving next after this report. What we wanted to do was include in this report the key themes and messages that we are now going to elaborate much more in the actual letter. So we wanted to connect the two and not just simply be silent on the public health hearing and themes and findings and recommendations. So we included some of that in this report, even though really most of the work was done in 2014. The second item, of course, was a little thing called ICD-10 delay, which happened in April, as we all know, so that because this report included hearings and recommendations and advice on ICD-10 and the importance of, I mean, in pretty much all the letters that we wrote to the Secretary, we said to the Secretary, do not delay, stick with the deadline, this. And then all of a sudden we have to delay it. So we had an editor's note included in the report highlighting the fact that, you know, in April Congress passed the PAMA. Somehow PAMA spells AMA in it too, but in any case, the PAMA is the law that created the extension for this delay or this new delay of the HIPAA report, of the ICD-10. So that we included a little note saying, you know, we are now under a new delay and according to the law, and so we're going to be working on what are the priorities to do in between the time that we are now and the new deadline, which was announced by the Department of Health and Human Services to be October 1st, 2015, and rules are coming out about it, but at least have been formally announced. So we included those two items that are more things that happened in this year. But really the frame is what happened in 2012 and 2013, which there was a lot of things. There were a lot of things that happened in the administrative simplification side. We had a lot of administrative simplification activities happening, starting with the implementation of the brand new standards, including 5010 and the D.0 and 3.0. These are the pharmacy transactions. And 5010 is a new version of the administrative transactions that we are now implementing since January 1st of 2012, actually, so very much in time. We have adopted the standard for electronic fund transfer and has, as you have heard already, created a number of interesting developments and perhaps unintended consequences about that. And then we have the other standards that are on the works. And then we had the entire operating rules world, which came about because of the Affordable Care Act, having a provision that says now we have to establish national operating rule standards to be followed by cover entities. So we have a description of those and all the things that are happening with the three sets of operating rules that are being developed. The first one is operating rules for eligibility and claim eligibility and healthcare claim status, the second round being electronic fund transfer operating rules and electronic remittance advice, and the third round, which is the status of remaining operating rules, is the five transactions for which, or six transactions for which there's operating rules to be developed: claims, coordination of benefits, enrollment, premium payment, attachments, and prior authorization. And then we have also a section on COSET, and certainly ICD-10 was the biggest part of it. And then also on a section on identifiers, the state of adoption of health plan identifiers, which was the biggest activity in 2012-2013, and some adjustments to the national provider identifier. We highlight end-to-end testing and then highlight some of the compliance and enforcement with the administrative simplification provisions of HIPAA. So that's the chapter one, if you will, the entire chapter around this topic of administrative simplification advancements in 2012-2013. So chapter two, the big section two, was advancements in the implementation of HIPAA privacy and security policies and standards. And this was developed by our privacy and security subcommittee. So this covers basically the development since 2012, including the publication of the Omnibus Privacy Rule, highlighted some of the remaining yet to be finalized activities, including accounting of disclosures, highlighting some of the things around HIPAA and the Affordable Care Act with respect to privacy and security, and then a lot of the outreach activities done by the department. And really this highlights, even though there's a lot of things said here that are related to activities the department has implemented in terms of outreach with respect to privacy and security, a lot of it has come out of the advice and work that has been done by the privacy and security work group. So it was valuable to include all this in this report. And then enforcement was another section that we had in each of our major topic. So enforcement of privacy and security was included, and here it included a lot of the various enforcement activities, the highlights, and the most significant cases that have happened in privacy and security. And then the third major section was the standards and population health, and here we highlight basically the two probably most significant efforts of our population health subcommittee have worked on: the community health data initiative, as well as the public health data standards work, which we did, the standards subcommittee did with the population health subcommittee. And then our last section is the section dealing with a vision of the future, if you will, a vision for the future of administrative simplification and e-health. And here we sort of took the opportunity to highlight some of the key themes that we have been focusing on and identifying and working on related to this entire area of administrative simplification. Of course, the biggest one, the transformative changes that the healthcare industry is going through, including all the healthcare delivery reform, the payment reform, all the changes under the Affordable Care Act, and all the changes under the HITECH Act as well. And so all that transformation that we're going through implies that we need to really transform the way we do business in healthcare and the way we are currently doing business, which is in terms of administrative transactions, the usual suspect transactions, the claims and the payment and all these mechanisms. We need to begin to think about how they're going to be different into the future as all this transformation happens. Data stewardship, again, a major theme that we have been working on. The convergence of clinical and administrative standards, another major theme in terms of into the future. The roadmap for e-health, something that we continue to hear is a very critical element that we need to continue to work on, particularly sort of aligning and sequencing all the new and developing or upcoming requirements around the administrative transactions and other things that affect the people that have to comply with those requirements. We also talk about e-health standards and health reform, some of the interrelationship between the entire Affordable Care Act and electronic standards being used to exchange data to support the Affordable Care Act. And then really measuring success, the biggest part of all, is really are we doing a good job at trying to understand if all the things that we're doing are achieving the ultimate goal of administrative simplification, and how do we quantify that and how we monitor the achievement of that. And we're going to be even looking more into the future onto that as we get more specific into the task that an Affordable Care Act provision called for, which is, and Jim mentioned this at the beginning, the review committee function that we will be looking at working on into the future, measuring really success and measuring the effect of all this activity. So that is our report. The goal, the intent today was more to go through the general content and highlight some of the key themes, as I just said. I do have actually a red line document with all the changes that happened. 95% of those changes were primarily editorial in terms of grammatical and typographical changes, really, and corrections and things like that. And then there were about 5% true content in terms of clarification of certain statements or. But none of the changes, I assure you, none of the changes change the core concept that we have been documenting in the report basically since March or April of this year. So you have seen and you have reviewed the report. You have provided us with the feedback. And so I'm now ready to turn it back to our chair to continue the discussion and see if we can move it forward for publication.
So I'm not serious, but I've entertained a motion to approve it, and we could just get going.
I will so.
Seconded.
Okay, I want to.
For discussion, I would just like to say this is an unbelievable work of brilliance. I think it captures everything in an extraordinary way. And I will just add, on the 10th report, they sent it back because there wasn't a wet signature on it. So just make sure that you have a wet signature on it when it goes to Bain.
Will do.
I need help there. What in the world constitutes a wet signature?
I had to send it to Boston. I had to write it and send it back. And then
does it have to be in blue ink?
Yes.
Yes, we have to sign Federal Register notices that way.
All right. So I know Walter and Bob and Secretary, well, I can speak for the committee. We'll watch this be born and develop and everything. I think we share a deep understanding of the complexity and the amount of work this represents. So floor is open for further discussion, and particularly in attention to any details that you've spotted that are incorrect or unclear, or that you say, this doesn't seem quite right to me. I mean, this is your opportunity. So start with Leslie.
Yeah, I just also wanted to add a thank you to Maya for all of her hard work on the privacy
thank you.
Part of it. But in addition to that, I went through it to try to make it a little easier to read in a lot of places, and you have my comments on that, because it's a tour de force, and for somebody who isn't as familiar with it, my guess is that it's not light reading. Let's put it that way. Of course, it's not supposed to be, but. When I was doing that, I also noticed that we were a little bit cautious about what we said about the ICD-10 delay, almost as though it hadn't happened. And it seemed to me that some comments, just, you know, being right straight up, that this committee had urged that ICD-10 not be delayed in the past, and it's happened, but there are some clear issues about what a delay means. Might be a good thing.
This is specifically on the executive summary. This is the statement that we added in the editor's note, April.
I think it should not be in the form of an editor's note.
The reason was sticking strictly to the time frame,
right,
that this
right.
report was through December 31st,
that's exactly right.
And this happened after. And we did debate it, and I, like you, Leslie, would have been diving right in with both feet to say that this represented a setback.
Then I think the way the editor's note should be crafted would be to say, we're not saying anything about that because this report governs the earlier time frame.
Because of the time frame.
Right.
Okay.
All right, and I was just going to say that perhaps what we have to do is just add a statement in that editor's note that we will discuss in more detail in the next report to Congress, and that this is capturing the period of October 2011 to December. And then I think we'll cover it.
Okay.
Raj.
Yeah, addressing the delay, I think the fact that the Congress overruled the committee's and CMS objections was that physicians groups lobbied the Congress, and I see a lack of physicians representing in the committee hearings. We did not hear completely the physicians' point perspective. And that's why the physicians were so angry that they went to the Congress and brought about this delay. And I think if I may mention this several times, if not only the AMA but the subspecialist organization, the physicians that represent these organizations or the organizations that represent the physicians should make it a point or we should have them come and address the hearings here. They don't come here, but they go to the Congress.
Good point. And actually, we have in all our hearings about ICD-10 specifically invited, and we have been fortunate to have the representative from the American Medical Association. In fact, they were yesterday here, too. And they restated formally, although AMA's was meeting this week, and they were reassessing their current position regarding ICD-10. Reassessing doesn't mean that they're reconsidering it. They're just deciding whether they continue or not to have their same position. But as it was reported yesterday, the AMA official position has been and is that they are not in support of changing to ICD-10. That has been stated. It was stated. It has been stated. And we reflect that in the description of the ICD-10 perspective. We did hear two very distinct positions. One was relatively pretty much the rest of the industry, represented by, providers, health plan vendors, coders, a lot of organizations saying, we're past the decision as to whether this is, we're ready doing it, we're ready, getting ready to comply with it, let's keep the date firm, let's continue to push towards that. And then we heard from, and that's what we reflect in here, we heard from two constituents specifically, AMA and MGMA, representing the American Medical Association and the Medical Group Management Association, with respect to their position about ICD-10. And it was clear that they were continuing to be in that position, so much so that they reflected it into the congressional action. Yesterday, during the hearing, we were beginning to see some new possibilities with respect to bringing the two parties together, the two perspectives together, and trying to address the issues and concerns that AMA has consistently raised about adoption of ICD-10 and try to continue to move forward and maintain, in some ways, reinvigorate the momentum that we might be losing because of the delay. But AMA has consistently been represented in the hearings, and we have reflected the position in all our views. It's just that it is two very different views. And
Walter, Linda and Alex, help me out here, but I think Raj's comments here are consistent with what we heard yesterday about two things. One was the urgent need for robust educational outreach to clinicians all across the country who just don't have a clue they don't accept the premises about why this is important. They don't even know what the premises are. We heard repeatedly they just feel beleaguered, they're tired and they're beat up, and they're disillusioned with meaningful use and what their EHRs can actually do and all that sort of stuff. But we heard a consistent story, I think, all day long yesterday about the need for outreach from Medicare and HHS to the clinician community, particularly the physician community, to get a better pulse and blood pressure check about what the heck's going on out there with this. And it's a vector that Raj is pointing out here for us. This is something we probably ought to come back to help understand what those perspectives are. I believe that what's in the report is accurate and balanced from where we are in December of 2013. So I don't know. I didn't hear you, Raj, saying that you wanted to see something change in this report. I think you were just explaining why this has happened. But I think we would do well. But Alex, what do you think?
I think there's also a theme from yesterday of that the outreach that we've been doing so far really isn't hitting the mark. We need to step back and get creative about how we're leveraging the information flow into the provider community through the associations, through the specialties, but also change the messaging to make it much more evidence-based. Here's the value proposition. Here's what you can do. Here's a clear, simple thought process about what you should be looking at, considering, and what moving forward with. And so it's also applying our lessons learned. And that it's not all just about Medicare. It's going to have payment implications, but there's a larger issue also related to education related to what the vendor community is doing. I also think that Raj made a comment about we're not hearing from boots on the ground on this committee, and it has been a long-standing problem, even when I sat on the other side of the table, to get the practicing clinicians to want to come testify, be involved at this level, and so they tend to use, in my experience, their instruments that go directly to Congress because they see the value that'll give them the outcomes that they want, balancing their objectives.
Yeah, I mean, the other big message, of course, we heard was we need to also educate, if that's the right word, or inform Congress, not just the providers. We as an industry need to also inform Congress about this, and certainly as we approach March of next year, when the FBAR ends, Congress will be debating this again. I think that we need to bring this message as well to them. So we're hoping that this will serve as a base for informing Congress.
Jim?
Quick note, the American College of Physicians, the American Academy of Family Practitioners, and the American, whatever pediatrics is called.
American Academy of Pediatrics.
All have on their websites what look like fairly carefully designed educational materials for their members. So I think, you know, one of the issues we need to pay attention to is that AMA isn't the only organization representing physicians, and that physicians are not a solid block opposed to ICD-10, setting aside the wisdom of ICD-10 entirely. So I think there may be more under this, and just calling for more education probably is not going to change anything.
And to be fair, I mean, we shouldn't make this an AMA issue. Clearly, AMA has taken a position, and GMA has taken a position. Everybody has, and I think it's more an entire industry. We really need to bring the two together. That's what I realized yesterday, is really bringing the two together in a much more forceful and directive and collaborative way. So I think that's the chart that we have next.
I hope you had your hand up a minute ago. Right?
No.
Okay. I've attended yesterday's meeting virtually.
Lucky me.
Which, you know, maybe we'll have to create some type of new NCVHS award for anyone that can go through a 10-hour standards committee virtually. Linda did it last time.
Just a brief comment. Walter, we just got an email from CAQH to make some adjustments.
Yes, we have
minor,
that.
Minor adjustments.
There's additional edits. You know, we reference CORE.
CAQH CORE.
And it should be, we referenced throughout the report something called CORE. You all know CORE is the acronym for the organization that develops the operating rules. The appropriate reference they are requesting us to include is CAQH CORE. So in every place with C CORE, we'll just adjust it.
Okay, we've got our first adjustment. What's the next one?
Can I just say, it's a wonderful report, and it really is a reference report. I think really we'll use it in HHS to brief the secretary as well. But as an annual report, we report what we know and what's been reported to us. We observe and make some closure. We did make recommendations. We've had that as a rule,
yes.
And I just wanted to confirm that we don't have.
We don't have any recommendations. Good point, yes. That's right. In this report, we do not make recommendations. We summarize the things that happen, and in fact, we highlight the recommendations we made in those.
It's really the work we've done.
It's
a retrospective review. So anything that was in any of the letters summarized what the aim and the goals and the recommendations that were made, so that it becomes, but nothing for future or anything that's current.
Yeah.
Well, Walter, I'd suggest that we get everyone to go to page 53, I think it is, where we do look at section 6, the conclusions. We have two paragraphs there.
Conclusions?
Yes. These are not recommendations, but these are there's two or three observations here that I want to make sure the committee knows are being made.
So should I read it or no?
I think it's got a dress code. We'll just take a minute and let anyone. I just want all the committee members, if you have any concerns about these conclusions, it would be nice for you to surface them now.
Should say highlighted.
Should say highlighted.
Yes, we. This version was just highlighting instead of highlighted. NCDA has highlighted.
So my own personal reaction to this is the first sentence and the second paragraph. Yeah. That's a mouthful. And that has, from my perspective, very important implications. We are required by statute to, as is noted in the appendix, there's a list of things that we're required to do about this. One of the most important things this the work of this helped me understand is that how different the world is 20 years later. And, you know, we talk about this in our subcommittees and in the hallway with one another and each other about how, you know, there's stuff in this law that we're not sure makes a whole lot of sense anymore. You know, and so that second sentence, then, it's this unknown future that affects our role as a statutory advisory body. Are everybody comfortable with there are implications here that there's more to come, there's more to come that doesn't necessarily look like HIPAA.
So I actually went back and forth a lot on that sentence because I think we want to convey that it's the unknown future that everybody is going to be called on to address. If we could say that, the way it's put right now, it sounds like an open invitation to change our role.
Yeah, it questions our role, which I don't.
Yeah, I don't think we.
I don't think that's what.
That's not what we meant.
No, I don't think that's what's meant. But
so would you?
Yeah.
That's what it says, and so if it said something like, "It is the unknown future that NCVHS, the department, and other relevant bodies will need to address,"
yeah.
Or it is. This, you know.
Yeah, you know, Lissy, I like the thing you said first better than that.
Yeah,
the first thing you said, I think I can call it back up, is the unknown future that will affect everyone,
mm-hmm.
that in turn will affect the role of NCVHS.
I wouldn't say role.
Will raise
the kinds of issues that NCVHS will need to
address. We'll advise, we're not questioning the role.
Yeah,
I just wanted to follow on to Jim's comment. If I were reading this, I would like to know that there are no specific recommendations in this, but that there are recommendations somewhere else that this references. I would make that the first sentence in the report.
Yeah.
So those are probably in the individual.
It's in the
report.
But all I'm saying is that sort of roadmap.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
nothing, no new recommendations here. There are recommendations here, here, and here, and here. And, I mean, you know, you with an executive, you have, what, 2 minutes, 3 minutes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One page. And if we did that first and then everything else followed, everything else is great.
Sentence at the beginning.
You do that right up front in the
first
and the summary.
And maybe in the cover letter and the first
Are we okay with these, Carol?
Yeah.
What you see up here?
Will affect everyone, I think is what you said.
Yeah, affect everyone rather than NCVHS.
That will affect, should we then add instead of NCVHS, say will affect
and it's sort of
department and other relevant parties.
I think what we'll
add other
is it will make NCVHS's role even more important.
That's where we.
Yeah, I would say.
Yeah, it's the leadership that we have to do in response to.
Could you repeat that again?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It is the unknown future that will.
That will make NCVHS's traditional role even more important. I think that's really what people are saying.
The role comes back in. I thought the controversial.
Well, but the thing is, what Leslie was saying is this: the original reading sounded like we're questioning the role and think it needs to be changed. What I'm proposing is what we're really trying to say is NCHS's role is even more important in this dynamic, uncertain future than when things are just rolling along.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah, so if you can say something about... I wouldn't say...
I think that's too self-serving. We get your point.
Yeah.
I agree.
We'll make the kind of advice and guidance even
that more important. Maybe that will require NCVHS and other entities to be more,
vigilant,
engaged. I don't know. The point is essential.
We're in a new world of collaboration. We've never seen. We don't even know the problem
that will require
that we're going to have to solve. I mean, we're getting down to the hard stuff.
Can I also cavil about the third sentence?
Let's see if you can. Let's see if we have this one agreed.
Well, I haven't changed anything yet.
I think that
that will require NCVHS and other entities like us.
I think it's important to keep the statutory advisory on
okay,
health information policy to the department there.
How about it will underscore the role of NCVHS?
The underscore the importance of...
How about will require the attention on...
Underscores the importance of the role of NCVHS?
Well, of NCVHS and
top
role. As,
Underscores.
Underscores the importance of NCVHS as...
As the statutory
advisory
body.
All right. Underscore
the importance.
That underscores the importance
of NCVHS as the statutory body.
Yeah.
So I think what we have now takes in what everybody else has been talking about, because we're not talking about other entities.
Okay, let's see your other sentence.
So I don't think we're just a venue for industry stakeholders, and it reads that way, the next sentence.
Sorry.
That's true.
The next sentence, NCVHS will continue to
provide? We'll serve as a venue?
Are you saying you want to get the word industry out?
A venue.
Well, I mean, we're a venue for the generation of advice on all these kinds of policies.
Right.
And some of that comes from industry stakeholders. Some of it comes from patients.
Some from communities.
Some from communities.
So could we just take the word industry out?
From deliberative work.
Well,
a venue for
deliberation.
Right.
Yeah.
For
constituents.
Just take out industry and say,
deliberations
and recommendations about these difficult and evolving issues.
There is a fashion right now to be a convener, and that's fine, and conveners are needed, and obviously we convene hearings to gather information. What I hear Leslie saying is NCVHS is fundamentally a deliberative recommending body, which obviously needs to be listening like crazy, but we're not just a convener. That doesn't, we convene as a part of our work of deliberation.
About these difficult and evolving issues?
Well, I think that these complex. About these complex.
And I changed this to these.
I think venue is non-data, Inc. You could just say continue to provide deliberations and recommendations.
Yeah, that's good.
That's good.
the reason that venue was put in was because this was is perceived, NCVHS is perceived by the stakeholders to be a place where they can come and bring their ideas and their discussions, and so we wanted to make sure that we made that the
for collaboration. We forgot the word then. So
and we would put in the collaboration on top of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we can have a venue for convening, deliberating, and recommending.
Yeah.
We've got collaborative in the mix.
Yeah.
We already got that.
Sentence and environment.
Yeah.
We've got collaborative
environment.
Environment.
Yeah.
Why don't we see if we can stop right there? What, don't we pretty much have this?
Yeah, except we need to change this to these.
Yes.
Go back.
You know, I would take
change
this out
these?
Completely
yes.
About...
These.
That's kind of limiting, isn't it?
Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Leslie, did you have another issue? Anyone else have another issue?
So the changes we'll make here will go to the summary as well because it's the same.
Correct.
Yeah, we'll
make the summary.
Right.
Yeah.
You noticed that.
Right? Let me ask a policy and procedures question to Debbie. Is there some reason why we have to wait till tomorrow to approve it with these changes?
Not at all.
The chair.
Are you?
Let me ask one. We're having the next round of discussions around the public health standards discussion in a little bit.
That's correct.
And there's direct language in this report from that. So if we approve this now, if we make changes in that, they need to be retrofitted. And how you handle that.
Okay, so I bet we could do that.
Do you envision that it would be substantive changes, or
we bill's just reserving the right to that if before our meeting is over.
No, it's true.
If we make some changes that are referenced in here, that we will come back and make a. Make this
we
report
make,
conform.
We need to make that for sure.
To make the conforming changes.
Yeah, conforming changes.
One more.
I love the language that you have mastered.
Just one more unease. The word these, could we have deliberations and recommendations about complex and evolving health information issues? Would that be clearer?
Health data.
That's good.
Or health data,
good.
But...
Yeah,
okay. We don't only talk about HIPAA, and since this is a report on HIPAA, I think that would be limiting.
Okay.
That's good.
All right. So by consensus, we're comfortable with the edits at the conclusion section. I think we need to go back to Jim's point about wanting another sentence in the at the beginning in the executive summary, correct? Well, can we go back to the executive summary?
The executive summary? The beginning?
Yeah, all the way to the beginning. I think that was the first sentence that Jim said is at the beginning.
Yep, that's Genesis, I think.
This is the beginning of the executive summary.
So which is the change?
The idea is to say the
microphone.
Is to put the business in first.
This is Jim. If I pick this up, I'm saying, what am I supposed to do with this? And what are the questions I need to answer? What am I supposed to do if I'm the secretary or whoever? And it seems to me that it's wise in documents like this to put the business in first and say, you know, there are no, I guess from what Jim Scanlon said, there are no new recommendations in this document. So that would be first sentence, period. And the second sentence would be, I guess there are specific recommendations elsewhere, and maybe identify where they are so that the person knows what they're doing here.
Terry, do you have a suggestion for how to do that?
Would you do that after the first sentence?
Yeah.
This is the 11th.
It's the second sentence.
So it would be the second sentence that you would say that there, within this document there are
sure.
no new requirements or new recommendations. However, we do summarize or we do reference recommendations within the document that we've made during this time period.
Yeah.
And they are, so that they're footnoted.
Yeah, footnoted throughout.
Because then you primed the reader to be looking for something.
Yeah, I think it's a good
thing. We have the objective.
Do any of you object to adding this sentence in front?
I don't object to it, but I don't like the way it's phrased.
Yeah.
Well,
okay, so we want to do it. So now Vicki and Leslie.
So,
Linda, did you?
One thing, and I don't know how to, you know, I sent you a whole variety of things, but there are a lot of sentences that are longer than they could be if we wrote directly. So take the first sentence. It could read, this 11th report describes the advances. Included in the description are recommendations, are summaries of earlier recommendations, but the purpose of this report is descriptive and no new recommendations are included or something like that.
Okay. Can you
replay otherwise
that?
Included in the description are summaries of recommendations made by SVHS. In the past.
Previously mentioned.
In this period.
During this period.
During this period.
Okay.
And then.
There are no new recommendations.
There are no new recommendations?
No. But the purpose of this report is descriptive. But the purpose of the report is to describe developments rather than to make any new recommendations. No, I would make it all one sentence.
The purpose. The purpose. I just say get rid of while.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't say what.
Take it. So you say that this report, this is a descriptive report.
Yeah, perfect.
That's it.
We have described, descriptional, and descriptive. Right?
Okay.
No, we already got recommendations.
Right.
Oh, I said, you're right.
So we're saying that we've described the previous ones, but not new ones. Does that address what you wanted?
Well, I would personally prefer to get rid of this descriptive report.
Yeah.
I think we just say this report contains no new recommendations. That was Jim's starting contention. That needed to be made clear.
You could say while, like a transition sentence. While.
So Terry.
While they're.
How do you want to do this?
Am I included in the description or summary?
We started out putting the word while when we were saying while this report is descriptive, so it seems to make sense there.
Maybe.
But we're just saying now that this, we could say that while this report contains
recommendations
and summaries from the past, it does not provide any new recommendations for the future.
Yeah, I think that's
better. Well, we can skip the while and just say this report contains summaries of recommendations made by NCHS during this period.
Well, it makes it easier.
While
this report.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, at the beginning. All the way in,
at the beginning.
Say, while this report includes, and then go all the way to summaries.
Yeah.
Summaries of recommendations. Include summaries.
Well, this report summarizes recommendations.
That's even better. Includes summaries.
Sure.
Forget word includes and just say this report summarizes.
This is reminding me of days gone by when we wrote as a committee.
It was like a
Rorschach. You could see our preferences for active and passive verbs.
And what we do in this case is we start to introduce.
It's a clear reference to whatever.
Larry, from the future perspective, you know, we've had a tremendous amount of work done here, and we're now introducing a lot of last-minute variability in writing style, and maybe what we need to do is step back and take a lesson learned, which is it's very difficult for the person pulling all of this together to create a synthesized, edited, crisp version of it. Maybe we need to look at some additional support, because this was hard to pull together, and I think the feedback's great, but...
I do like Jim's suggestion that references recommendations would be better than summarizes. That suggests we're changing
what they were.
That's actually what it does.
I am watching.
Also, can we get
sure
in that any of those suggestions that are made do not change the flow or the tenses or anything in the document, because that would be a nightmare to do at this time. But I think I do think it's a good suggestion that we're right up front saying that there's nothing new, that this is what the objective of the report is, and that's good.
So I think...
Can we get in the notion of past and future? Because to me, when you just say, it does not contain any new recommendations, some people might go, well, do I need to read it?
Future.
Yeah, but it's recommendations for the future, and that the others are in the past.
We just added that in. We talked about that, and it was just left out. So we're saying that we're summarizing recommendations that were made in the past or during that time.
Made by NCVHS.
No, during this period.
And then we're talking about that there's nothing new for the future.
Okay.
So we have the past and the future.
Right.
Okay, so it's 12:13. We have the opportunity to go to lunch if you're ready. With these edits...
There's already a motion on the floor.
You already have a motion to do that. And we have consensus edits that we have now talked through that bring the front end and the conclusions at the back end, which that was just my doing here. I wanted to make sure the committee knew the setup and knew where it landed and that we were agreed about that, and we appear to be. So are you ready to vote? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Any abstaining? I think we can reconvene at 1 o'clock. Hold on. We have to have a count for dinner.
The applause still holds. Yeah. Before you jump up.
All
fine. We want to know who's going to be joining us at Oya Restaurant. Hopefully at 6:30. I know you'll be finishing at 5:30, and there's some logistical plans of you either getting back to your hotel or heading over there. But we do have the address and all. Anybody interested, and I'll get a count. And again, we might have a special guest. All kinds of guests. So
really?
Count here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So we'll reconvene at 1. Thank you very much.
Good luck.